You're listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in for Leonard LoPate today on 82 degrees. It feels like a cool summer afternoon here in New York City. On December 30th, 2009, the CIA suffered one of the deadliest attacks in a quarter of a century when seven people were killed inside a CIA base in Khost, Afghanistan. The murderer was a doctor named Houman al-Balawi, who had been recruited by the CIA as a double agent, one who promised tantalizing access to top leaders within al-Qaeda. But his true allegiances were more fluid and complicated. The story is chronicled in a new book, The Triple Agent, The Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA, by Pulitzer Prize winner Joby Warwick. It's published by Doubleday, and I'm pleased to welcome Joby Warwick to the Leonard LoPate Show today. Hello.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
One of the things that struck me when I read your book is that it tells the story of this terrible event, but it's really a character study, both of the CIA agents and the people working with them and of the man who blew himself up and killed seven other people. Was that important to you, to give us a sense of the people behind this story?
This was the fascination to me as I got started in this process. I'm a reporter at The Washington Post. I cover intelligence. I happened to be working on the day that this event took place. And we're all caught up in the story and this horrible tragedy. It was the worst thing to happen to the CIA in 25 years. But as I began to uncover layers, that what became appealing to me was understanding both the bomber, the person that did this, who's a very complicated, interesting person, but also the human beings on the other side, the CIA officers who live and work in places that we don't know about, we don't know what their jobs are like, and to get some access and to understand what they are like as human beings and as people working on our behalf was an incredibly interesting experience.
Let's start with the bomber himself. How did you begin to piece together who this man was?
A couple of ways. For one thing, he left us a trove of material in terms of his own writings. He came to the attention of the Jordanian intelligence service in the beginning because he was a secret internet blogger who was writing on jihadist websites, agitating for al-Qaeda, trying to get people to participate in attacks against the West. And so he left us a great trove of material about his own feelings and opinions, and this continued, as it turns out, through his journey, as he went to Pakistan, as he did these amazing things, giving us insight into who he was and what he was thinking. But more than that, you know, I had to go to where he came from, go to the house where he lived, talk to his family members, talk to loved ones and associates, and put together what this person's psychological journey was about. It was fascinating and horrifying at the same time.
You go to his house and meet with his father. What was that like? And where is it? And what was his father like?
So to set the stage a little bit about this man's background, he's a Palestinian national living in Jordan, which is a fairly modern, relatively affluent Arab society. He's a pediatrician by training. So he's a smart man. He's been abroad to study. He has a fairly normal job working in a refugee clinic looking after children and mothers. And he's, you know, growing up both in relative prosperity but in the sense of persecution. His family was, you know, his father was born in what's now Israel. They're looking across the border at what used to be their land. And so there's a sense that something's been taken from him and from his family. And this is, he becomes an angry young man as he gets older. And this is something that motivates him, as we see the story, to do terrible things.
That's an interesting phrase, an angry young man as he gets older, because we think about young people, maybe teenagers, early 20s, starting to feel this passionate, which turned out in this case a passionate hatred. Mm. But it seemed like this caught him later in his life.
It did. And I think his work had something to do with it, because he's working every day with Palestinian refugees. And he's dealing with their aches and pains. And when there's shelling or when there's violence, he sees those patients as well. So this is part of his daily life. And he becomes more and more angry about, Western governments that perpetuate what he sees as a great injustice. And he's looking for a way through his religion, through his writings, to try to respond and to do something, profound about it.
So he becomes radicalized against the West and writes about it. And then he's caught.
Yeah.
And he undergoes a very difficult time.
Yes. So the Jordanian intelligence agency know about this blog. They know that he's very popular. He's not just someone writing in obscurity. Thousands of people are tuning into what he has to say every day because he's very colorful. He writes very descriptively and very graphically about what's going on in Iraq and other places. But they, when they find out it's just this mousy little doctor right under their noses, then there's a rush to take him, to arrest him, to question him, to see what they can do to switch to change him around. So he gets picked up, arrested in the middle of the night on one evening in January of 2009, brought to the interrogation center, which is one of the most feared places in all of Jordan, and he's questioned for 3 days. And he ends up breaking down pretty quickly because he's not a terrorist, he's not a hardened criminal, and he essentially collapses and says, okay, yeah, I'll tell you whatever I know. And he just spills his, you know, whatever he information knows about internet connections and that sort of thing.
Does torture happen in these Jordanian prisons?
One would have expected it. In fact, the place where he was interrogated has a nickname in Jordan. It's called the Fingernail Factory, conjuring up all kinds of horrible images. In the case of Balawi, none of that happened, according to his own account. It was more a matter of the usual stuff, the sleep deprivation, blindfolding, hour after hour of questioning, and it took only that little bit to make him break down.
So here he is. He's someone who was known to the authorities as being anti-the government and what's going on. How does he make the transition then to someone who is being coddled by the CIA to become a double agent?
Yeah, this is so unexpected because, again, someone with no history of being an informant of any kind. He's just been in the Jordanian's custody for 3 days, so it's not very long for someone to be expected to flip. But the Jordanians are interested in him because he's got, first of all, he's got these internet connections. He talks to people that they're interested in. He's also a doctor, so he has access to places. People need medical care. So they become interested in him as an informant of some kind. And once he's in their clutches, he doesn't really have any choice anyway. He has to do what they tell him to do. And so you have this man who's got this anger, this ideological hatred. On top of that, he's been humiliated and shamed, and he's looking in some way to try to strike back. And when this idea is dropped onto him about possibly becoming an informant, he begins to see the germ of a way forward, a way to try to strike back.
This gets at the heart of the complicated nature of looking for informants, because the people then who are working with him are thinking that he's on their side, but he's not. I mean, you call him a triple agent here, which is a fascinating term.
Yes. Yeah, there are many flavors of informants, and some are just the lowlifes, you know, the people who get paid a few bucks to rat on their neighbors and that kind of thing. And then there are the ones who are professionals who the intelligence agency spent many years training them. They create cover stories. They insert them into other countries and let them operate for years to try to get access to the people they wanted to get to. And this man was none of the above, but he was someone who was talked into becoming a double agent for the CIA, spying on Al-Qaeda. At the same time, his allegiances were really for the other side the whole time.
I'm speaking with Joby Warrick, who is a Washington Post reporter and has written The Triple Agent, the Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA, and it's from Doubleday. Who is the man who was charged in Jordan to try to bring this man onto their side as a double agent?
A fascinating character. His name is Ali Ben Zayed, and he is an intelligence officer for the Jordanian Mukhabarat, which is their intelligence service. And interestingly, he happens to be a royal. He's a cousin to the king, Abdullah II of Jordan. So he's someone who has, you know, he's of means. He's Western-oriented. He went to school in the United States. He even interned for Senator Kerry at one point. So he knows us, knows our culture, and he knows the spy world, and he knows the CIA very well. The two work together on a lot of cases, and he's close friends with CIA officers. He turns out to be the sort of the handler for our bomber, Balawi, and he is the one person who is consistently in contact with him throughout this entire story.
How did the story turn so deadly wrong? Were there moments within it where this man from Jordan or the CIA handlers might have gotten an inkling that there could have been a problem here?
Yeah, they certainly had questions and doubts. But what happened after Balawi went to Pakistan, which is where he ends up going for the CIA, disappears in the tribal country for weeks, and no one really hears from him. When he reemerges, he comes up with evidence. It's so compelling and so electrifying that it gets the attention of everyone back in Washington all the way up to the White House. He's finding really good stuff. And the book describes a lot of this, but everything from help with drone strikes, with videotaped evidence that he's in the presence of senior al-Qaeda leaders, and then the real bombshell, he intimates that he's been in contact with the number two al-Qaeda leader at the time, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's now, of course, the number one leader of al-Qaeda.
And this was all a wonderfully put together theatrical presentation, because it sounds like there was a lot of thought on the bomber's part and on the people who were working with him to create a fascinating story that did exactly what it did to get the CIA's attention.
Exactly. We think of the CIA as the masters of the clever ruse, and they're great at making front companies and illusions and setting up these elaborate traps. In this case, al-Qaeda did exactly the same thing, and they turned out to be quite good at it, far better than any of us would have imagined, but using everything, you know, things that would appeal to us, things they know would resonate, video information, not just reports, but evidence that he was with senior al-Qaeda leaders, all kinds of things that were just set up to make us just salivate. We're really getting close to getting somebody important, and they played it perfectly.
Could they have learned something from us when we were training the Mujahideen in Afghanistan all those years ago, or are these tricks that they might have learned subsequently to that?
Well, interestingly, some of the CIA officers who looked at this tragedy in the aftermath believe that, but yes, indeed, that al-Qaeda has been studying us. Some of them have been in Guantanamo and they're out again. So they know what information we're looking for. They know what's going to appeal to us. And so they very carefully and patiently built this elaborate trap that they knew would be completely irresistible.
In Coast, there was a group of CIA agents and also people working with them. Can you describe them? Who were the people that died in this tragedy?
Yeah. There's an interesting mix of people, including some of the CIA's top al-Qaeda experts. The one woman who ran the base, she was the base chief, she was in her mid-40s, had been back in Virginia, one of two or three top al-Qaeda experts within the agency. She'd helped track down some of the major terrorist figures after 9/11. She was very smart, very savvy, but at the same time, she had never worked overseas in a war zone before, so this was a brand new posting for her. There were people who were targeters. There's a young woman who was just 30 years old, a very attractive, very dynamic young lady, whose job it was to try to weave together information about people were going after senior terrorist figures by collecting intelligence from intercepts, from informants, from wherever we could get them, and building a dossier and then sort of moving the chase forward until they actually found the person. So people like that, there are guards, Blackwater people who are in charge of looking after security at a base like this, and just people who do the technology, the fancy gadgets and tricks that they could arm the informant with so he could do his job, a whole range of people. And on this day, 7 Americans were killed all at once, which is an incredible loss for the agency.
Why did these people let their guard down enough to allow a man who was strapped with explosives into the CIA headquarters there?
The great irony of this is when this man was coming to Coast for a meeting, the entire focus was on keeping him safe. We got to make sure that nobody...
Keeping him safe.
He's coming to kill them. They're worried about his well-being. They're worried about getting him out of Pakistan, where he is, into Afghanistan, and back home quickly before nobody misses him. They're worried about him possibly being seen by spies for the Taliban and discovered. And for that reason, they took all kinds of precaution that he would not be seen, including not letting him be searched at the gate when he first arrived.
They even baked him a birthday cake.
Because this is someone that they wanted to make feel completely welcome. Balawi had a birthday just the week before. They knew that. They wanted to sort of have this very dramatic showing of him being welcomed and encouraged. So he shows up at this gathering. There are 14 Americans and Jordanians and Afghans. They're ready to meet him. A birthday cake gets on his way. And, of course, he gets out of the car with a 30-pound bomb strapped to his chest.
I'm speaking with Washington Post reporter Joby Warrick. His book, The Triple Agent, The Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA, is published by Doubleday. We'll be back with more after a break. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate on this Wednesday afternoon, and I am speaking with Joby Warrick, who is a Washington Post reporter who has written a book called The Triple Agent, The Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA. And it's from Doubleday. Joby, how do you go about covering these things that are everybody is trying so hard to keep undercover? What, as a reporter, are the ways that you get the story?
This is probably the hardest reporting challenge of my life, and I cover the intelligence community, so it's always hard. Just to give you a sense, I mean, we all know about drone strikes in Pakistan, but it's a secret program the CIA cannot officially acknowledge. So getting to even say, yes, things go boom in Pakistan is something that nobody wants to commit to saying. And to get them to talk about this story when you have everything is secret, the base is secret, the double agent, the triple agent was certainly secret. And so it was a matter for me of assembling many pieces from very many sources. I traveled to Jordan. I traveled to Afghanistan. I traveled to Turkey. I went all around the United States, talked to each one of the families that was affected by this tragedy, talked to CIA officers who were current and former, because really everybody had this yearning in common to understand what had happened here. And nobody knew the whole story, including the CIA, when it first happened. So it was a matter of trying to reach out to so many people and hear the same stories over and over again until I felt like I had a narrative that weaved it all together.
There seemed to be some dissonance among the people in Coast about what they should do with this agent. And there, from the story that you tell, it sounds like some people wanted to bake him a birthday cake, and other people said, let's really be careful here. Yeah. How did that drama work itself out before he arrived?
The people who were most cautious and most skeptical were actually the ones that knew Balawi the best, the Jordanians, including the ones back in Amman who had watched this case come to fruition. They were all excited potentially about what this man could do, but they were worried that it was a bit too much. It was a bit too good to be true. Interestingly, they were worried that he might be a con artist, that he wanted money, that he was just giving them a bunch of lies. They weren't worried that he was going to walk into a meeting and blow himself up. They wanted to slow things down, but they also did understand that they had to see him. Somehow, some way, they had to arrange a meeting with this man to get him in a room where they could look at him in the eye, figure out what he was all about. And everybody agreed that that had to happen.
When you cover a story like this, and then you're writing a book years after it happens, what is it like to be writing a story that is still going on? In fact, probably just about the time your book was going to press, Osama bin Laden was killed.
Yeah.
So as a writer, how do you deal with a story that really isn't over yet?
Yeah, it's still unfolding in many ways. And of course, the tragedy took place, and we're still learning things today about elements of that. But it is true that the interesting part of the story that unfolded as I was writing the book was the death of Osama bin Laden. And some of the same CIA officers who were killed at Coast had worked on that bit of the search as well. They had been looking for these couriers that were rumored to be going back and forth to some secret location where Osama bin Laden was based. And in that sense, it was a bit of a payback and a vindication for the sacrifice that so many people made on that day. But in that, it was really a moving target, and yet it did come to kind of an interesting climax at the end with Osama bin Laden's death.
As someone who has followed this community for such a long time, what do you see has changed since the events in Coast those years ago?
You know, we read every day about people who are killed in Afghanistan and servicemen, and we mourn their deaths. But for the CIA, things like this don't happen. You don't lose seven Americans in a single day. And so for the agency, this was a crisis. There was grieving. There was soul searching. There was a lot of finger pointing initially, trying to figure out who was responsible for this terrible tragedy. And the thing they managed to bring out of this was, first of all, a resolve. We see an intensified search for Osama bin Laden, for some of these senior leaders that eventually, a year later, led to a success. But you also see this looking back at spycraft, the things that you know, we used to do so well back in the Cold War that have been a little bit more lax because the CIA is stretched so thin in Afghanistan and Iraq. And so they've had to look at things like counterintelligence. How do we vet our informants? How do we make sure that these guys are really good guys and then we're not being fooled by the other side? And so that's all been kicked up a notch from where it was just a year and a half ago.
Has it made gathering information that much more difficult because there's more suspicion, which is probably warranted?
Yeah. Well, it's one thing it's done, it's given the other side a template for how they possibly can penetrate our side. And there actually have been other attempts since then by Al-Qaeda and Taliban people to try to worm their way into installations with promises of information. And, of course, the agency's eyes are wide open and looking for these things now, and they've been thwarted. But they're, you know, it's interesting. There have been so many double agents in the history of spycraft that have been rogues and cheats and liars and informants that just were disappointing in various ways. No one had ever blown himself up. So it was kind of a failure of imagination in not anticipating that such a thing could happen to the CIA till it really happened.
That always seems to be a problem, is that you're whatever we're in, we're looking at the things that have happened rather than the scenarios that could have happened. I've heard that the CIA has brought in people like filmmakers and novelists to imagine things that might happen that nobody's really thought of before.
Yeah, that's true. And I think some of that is also in the aftermath of the 9/11 failures and the Iraq WMD failures, the sense that we need to grapple with this groupthink that sometimes can paralyze a bureaucracy where everybody's thinking along the same lines. So they do this red teaming now, and they do bring in outside experts and
red
academics.
Red teaming?
They call it red teaming. So we almost have a team pretending to be the bad guy, pretending to be the one that's trying to defeat you. And they go at it pretty hard, and they throw all kinds of things to the agency to see how they'll react. But it's a great mental exercise, and it prepares you for the real crises when they happen.
Do you, as a reporter, get to actually see these things in action, or do you just get to hear about them from people who've been part of them?
A lot of it is done in secret, so you do hear about it secondhand from individuals who are involved in it. But there's certain things you have to see yourself. I had to see the base and coast, and I had a interesting struggle just getting there because the base itself is secret. You know, people who don't have clearances can't walk onto it. The only way I was able to get there was to hitch a ride with a bunch of Taliban prisoners who were being released from a prison. So I flew from Bagram to Khost in a chopper with, I think, a dozen these ragged, bearded Taliban ex-cons who were being released to their hometown. And that was my free ride to Khost, and that's how I got to see the place.
So you got to Khost, but were you able to actually get in to the CIA base?
Could see the base, could look all around, could not actually get inside. But I had other ways of getting inside visually with photographs and satellite photos and even got some agency people to map out, well, here's this building, here's where this took place, here's the cafeteria. And so I felt I have a really great, you know, mental image of exactly what happened where.
One of the things that's fascinating in your book is looking at the team that was assembled to try to deal and to get information from this informant. And it included, as you described, two women who were really extraordinary analysts, and the young woman was a targeter, and then also people who were much more experienced at the on-ground spycraft. What is it like when those two different groups work together?
Yeah. This is an institutional problem right now for the CIA. For years, the people who were the on-the-ground folks, they're called case officers, and they really the people in charge of the CIA. They were the glamour people, and they had the important jobs. They did the backroom meetings in Cold War cities, you know, during the Cold War. But in the modern era, they're not so much in charge because there's other kinds of intelligence that has become paramount, like intercepts, like the electronic surveillance that we do, and the analysis of bringing all these pieces of information together. It's a different skill set than sitting across a table from an informant. And so these two, often they clash together. They have different ideas about what's important and how things should be done. And for a lot of people, this was a case study of these two worlds colliding. The case officers wanting to go slow, being skeptical, not trusting, and the others, the ones who were the desk jockeys back in Langley, having other ideas about how to run an operation. And it eventually the ones who were the case officer were overruled, and those cautions were put aside.
I'm speaking with Joby Warrick, who is a Washington Post reporter and also the author of the new book, The Triple Agent, the Al-Qaeda mole who infiltrated the CIA. And it's about an event where an Al-Qaeda operative blew himself up in coast Afghanistan in a CIA base and killed seven officers and people working with them. And you are listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC and WNYC.org. One of the things also that struck me, because of the way you describe these people, the Americans as well as the Jordanians, all of these people are people with family. The man who blew himself up had a wife who had translated, she's Turkish, I guess, and she had translated a biography of Osama bin Laden, and he had children, and the Jordanian who was trying to turn him also had a family. The Americans, almost all of them, had husbands, wives, children. What was it like for you as someone who also has a family to look at all of these people who are doing these incredibly difficult jobs and think about what their lives are like? Yeah.
This is what made it real to me, because I got to know the families, and they were still grieving and are still grieving to this day about the loss of loved ones, of sometimes fathers, husbands.
Mothers.
Yeah, mothers. There's a story about when the bodies first came back to Dover, as they always do, from Afghanistan. There wasn't a room big enough at the base for all these people to fit into the same place. There are little children running around and babies on people's laps. And so you get a sense of the human cost of this one tragedy. And, you know, but the helpful thing was that these family members wanted answers, and they had pieces of information. They'd receive emails and text, and they'd talk to their loved ones. They'd talk all the time, as it turns out. You wouldn't think there'd be that much communication, but by Skype and by email, so they're talking all the time.
And there were connections, too, between the family of the Jordanian agent who was killed and not a U.S. agent, and the families of some of the people from the U.S.
That's right. The Jordanian intelligence officer was best friends with one of the CIA officers, and they took vacations together. And you know, I sat in a house in Jordan and just looked at volumes of photographs of the two CIA and Jordanians together and all the vacations and trips they took. So these became very real people to me, and I wanted to tell a story that respected them and showed them as real human beings.
Were there things that you were told you could not talk about?
I was never told explicitly that you can't share a fact because it's classified. There'd be times when the agency, when I would approach them about information that I had gathered, they would just say, "Well, this is secret. We can't talk about it." But I think, you know, they're in a way they were interested in what I had learned as well, because I've been in places and talked to people that they perhaps had not talked to, particularly on the Pakistani side. And so it was, again, it was like assembling a puzzle in the dark in a way, with so many pieces that eventually are put together like a great mosaic and show a picture.
Is that complicated as a journalist and a writer to know that you're writing a story that actually is part of the story as well, that you're discovering things that the intelligence community may not know?
Yes, and it was exciting to a lot of my sources, because I talked to them regularly, and they said, "Well, what did you know now, or who have you talked to, and where did you just come back from, and I've heard this, and did you hear this?" And so there was a real give and take that sort of animated this process from the very beginning.
Does that make it complicated as a journalist, though, that, you know, usually you're trying to get information, but sharing information until the story is written is not usually what you're supposed to do?
Well, the thrill of it was like the thrill of discovery, because when I started out, I had my own sense of what probably happened. But at every turn, it was something different. It was always just a little bit, there's another twist that I hadn't anticipated. And so at every turn, there was something new, and this discovery was what really made it thrilling.
What is it like now to continue to cover this community and to look at what is going on? Do you look at stories now with all of this information that you've gathered and think, "I think this is something that they should be doing," but they're not?
Well, you know, we all have this caricature sense of the intelligence community. And when I first started covering this agency, I was as guilty as everyone else. Because what do we know about them? We know about them from Hollywood. We know about the times they screw up, you know, the times that the WMD case and things like that. But to get to know them as people, because they certainly are, they're not, you know, they're not these mythical all-knowing, you know, all-powerful agency. They're human beings, Americans working, you know, difficult jobs, often in secrecy, that the things that can't be shared or talked about. And I was just, it was fascinating for me to really get a sense of what their lives are like. And in having accomplished that, it gives you really a greater respect for the agency as it goes forward, because they're not superhuman. They're normal people doing a very difficult job, and you can see that every day as you work with them.
How about what you found out about Balawi, the man who blew himself up? Did that change your image of the people that were fighting?
I think that was the most surprising thing to me, was to get into his head as much as I could and to understand where he's coming from. And it teaches you several things. One is that these are not the people who are attacking us are not stupid. They're not naive. They're not, they're not people living in caves or young kids that are getting a few hundred bucks and a promise of 72 virgins to blow themselves up. This is someone who was smart. He was Western educated. He had aspirations of studying the United States. He understands our culture, but he also had a hatred born of personal experiences and sort of cultural experiences that was deeply ingrained in him, and he felt called by God to do something about it, to do something that involved up to the point of killing himself and killing other people. And he's not unique. There are other people who are like that out there, and we shouldn't underestimate what they can do.
I think that, as a reader, was the hardest thing for me to understand, partly because that kind of passion for destruction is so foreign to most of us, I think. Thank goodness.
And, you know, fortunately for me, the bomber, Balawi, presents to us his own mental anguish about what he's about to do, because he doesn't want to die any more than anyone else does. He's got two children. He's got a wife. He's worried about his father getting old and not being able to take care of himself. So he goes through this sort of mental, sort of talking to himself. What am I going to do this or not? Is it really worth it? If I kill myself, that's the last time I could do anything. Is it better to just be a foot soldier in Allah's army and just work day to day? And he was finally able to logically and rationally persuade himself that the best thing for him to do was to put a bomb on his chest, walk into a meeting, and blow himself up.
You say logically and rationally, but that doesn't sound possible to make a decision like that logically and rationally, partly because of all of the other things that you've just said.
Yeah.
It's there does seem to me, as I read about these things, that there has to be something, you know, here, if we say someone is telling us to do something, or we think people may be a little bit crazy if they're listening to voices and then going ahead and doing something very dangerous.
That's true. And that is another difference between what we do and what their mindset is like, that it comes to light during this reporting process, because we have very dedicated people on our side, people who work hard and they sacrifice family time and they sacrifice the personal comfort by going to a place like Afghanistan to work. And yet there's this whole layer of intensity on the other side, the side that's opposed to us, that is willing to do much more than that, that's willing to not just give up comfort and family time, but also willing to give up their own lives for their cause.
So when you look at all of this, do you see that there may be a way to reconcile this, to be able to, you know, we've been in Afghanistan for almost 10 years now, and in Iraq, and this struggle has been going on for a long time. Is there a way to be able to make a shift so that we're no longer killing each other?
Well, one thing that gives me hope is what we've seen in the last few months with the Arab Spring, because part of the bomber's motivation is this sense of rage against the West for oppressing his own people in his mind, but also for supporting governments that he sees as corrupt. And in the last few months, we've seen Al-Qaeda's message being discounted by popular revolts that have been mostly peaceful, that have driven some of these dictators from power. And the United States has come around to side with the people in most cases, is in favor of, you know, getting rid of these tyrants and installing democracy. So Al-Qaeda's message and this message that you have to, achieve, a just society through terrorism and death is not as relevant or not as resonant as it was just a few months ago. So I'm hoping this is the start of a turning point. That might be naive, but there has to be sort of political change on the ground that allows, a draining of the swamp, as people say, a way to address this anger and hostility that's raging out there now.
I've been speaking with Joby Warrick. He is a Washington Post reporter, and his book, The Triple Agent, The Al-Qaeda Mole Who Infiltrated the CIA, is published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
I sure enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.